Good evening, everybody. We are the Tri-State Sports Guys, live from lovely Norwalk, Connecticut. We will be joined by my co-host. I'm Dan Santarello, by the way, but we will be joined by my co-host, Mike DePalma, in a little bit. Got Neil Lynch calling in from the Hoboken Studios. In the meantime, I'm joined by the coach, Sean Ireland. Coach, what's up?
Nothing much. How's it going, Daniel?
It's good, buddy. We have a good show for you tonight. We have former UConn star, NBA first-round pick, Scott Burrell, calling in. Crossing our fingers, we'd love to talk to Mr. Burrell. And a little bit later in the show, we have a two-time major champion, John Daly, the big hitter, calling in to talk a little about Augusta National and a couple things he has going on in his life right now on the business side of things. So, Coach, the first thing we're going to get a little bit into as we wait for the Hoboken Studios to give us a ring, we're going to talk a little bit NBA playoffs. Now, you had a very good point off air, and neither one of us really had an answer for it, but shoot your point at us, and we'll break it down a little bit as best we can.
I just think it's crazy in all sports, but it happened twice within the past 24, 48 hours, and it just baffles me how going into the playoffs, everybody was like, you got Miami in the East, you got Indiana, but Indiana's on the down ball. Watch out for the Bulls. Watch out for the Bulls. Watch out for the Bulls. Now they lose two games, which they had in hand late in the game, and they let them slip away. Now everybody's like, the Bulls are done. The Bulls are done. The Bulls are done. The Wizards, that's the team to beat. Do people jump ship on the ship, off the ship, whatever, too quickly? I know it's only a seven-game series, and they're in a big hole, but to me it's just how it goes from one extreme to the other in literally 24 hours.
Yeah, you know, and you also mentioned off air, the Rangers-Flyers series. Rangers lose game two, they're done. We talked about the New York Football Giants a little bit. The Giants start with 0-6. Mm-hmm. They're done. They stink. Everything's done. We're going to bring Neil Lynch in right now from the Hoboken Studios. The guy's a Hall of Famer, consider extraordinaire. Neil, have you listened to what we're getting into here a little bit, or do I need to bring you up to speed?
We're on Hoboken time zone, so I'm a little delayed.
All right. What we have here is the coach, Sean Ireland, bringing up the fact that the Chicago Bulls coming into these playoffs were a team that people were saying, you know what, you got to watch out for these guys. You got to watch out for them. They fall behind two games to the Wizards. Now they stink. Now they're done. So what we're getting into a little bit of here is just the mindset of the media and what people get into. And I said to Coach off air, the interesting thing to me, and I think we kind of pride ourselves on it here at the Tri-State Sports Guys, is we're willing to eat crow. We're willing to admit that we thought the Giants were done, and they're not. I was willing to admit that I thought the Wisconsin Badgers were the worst friggin' college basketball team on the planet, and they make the Final Four. But my argument is, I don't think very many people, and many of the talking heads in the sports media, will ever admit to just being wrong. The Bulls don't stink any more than the Wizards are going to win the NBA title, but they're down 2-0. I've watched bits and pieces of that series. I've been more interested in the Nets and Raptors. But just your general feeling, Neil, about the sports media's just utter unwillingness to ever admit that they were off base a little bit. I mean, do you think that's what it is, or are we just a panicked society in every phase of the game?
Well, I mean, I think it comes down to you have a select group of people that have been labeled experts for one reason or another, and then people kind of jump on the bandwagon, and they get carried away with the momentum of those kind of picks, and people fall in love. I fall in love. We all fall in love with personalities, teams, you know, what have you. And it's interesting to see now that, you know, the tides have turned, and now everyone seems to be kind of getting on the Wizards bandwagon to see them make a push. I mean, I know that from my standpoint, I've never had beef with Washington basketball. I don't know why I ever would, but it'd be nice to see John Wall kind of make a push, and I just want to see new blood, and that's what it comes down to. But, you know, I'm kind of interested to know how the Bulls have made it this far. I know Thibodeau is a great coach, you know, Joakim Noah, Defensive Player of the Year, but it just seems like they lost a lot of players and, you know, didn't have D-Rose. So to me, it's kind of a testament to both Thibodeau and you know, the players that they were able to keep and keep healthy. So, I mean, you know, if you want to go that route, you know, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out because, you know, you have the Pacers who are kind of in a – who have been – you want to talk about media. and how the media is, like, warping the way we view things, you would think the Pacers are, like, the number 8 seed and that they're, you know, they're the Hindenburg at this point. And yet, you know, they're I think they're in the driver's seat, but who knows? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of infighting there. Roy Hibbert seems to be a problem. So, I mean, for me, it's like if you want to point at the media getting nuts, it's over the Indiana Pacers.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you there. I think in terms of the Chicago Bulls, the absence of Derrick Rose, I guess, just doesn't matter. I guess that's what we're supposed to believe, that you're not supposed to think this is a team that has a gaping hole at the point because of the fact that Joakim Noah is a very good player, and he's a defensive player of the year and all those things. Like I said, I'm not going to sit here and be a fake and say that I've seen a lot of that series. But in my experience watching Thibodeau and watching what he did building that great defense that they have with the Celtics, you know, it's probably just a couple little defensive breakdowns. People forget you have to win 4 games to win the series or whatever the case might be. So it's not like they're dead. In terms of the Pacers, all I heard was that this team is going to go all the way. I heard that for like 3 months now. And now they drop a game to the Hawks, and they suddenly are the worst team that's ever been assembled in the NBA. And to me, I just sometimes wonder, I guess, if the people that critique these games and analyze them actually watch them.
One of the reasons why they're just going nuts on Indiana, their last 25 games, I think they were 12-13. Not a true sign of a number one team, you know what I mean? So I think that had a lot to do with it also. Not just now you compound that with losing game one, now the Avalanche has already started, but when they lost game one, now it's coming down full-fledged.
Yeah, and you know, the funny part about that to me is the fact that it makes the Hawks a good team. And I think that's kind of, in my mind, what we're discussing here is, if you want to say the Pacers were 12-13 because they were, I get it. But then all of a sudden the stuff I heard was that the Atlanta Hawks now are very good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the interesting thing to me, because I didn't hear that from anyone.
Right.
I didn't hear anyone tell me that the Hawks were going to be good. Now they're good. Now it's not just the Pacers being bad, the Hawks are good.
Yeah. There's one guy I know who always thinks the Hawks are good, and that's Paco from Norwalk.
Yeah, the hitter. And you know what, dude? It's one of those things to me, and, you know, maybe Neil disagrees with this, but if you're going to put these teams up on a pedestal, okay, that's up to you as an analyst, as an expert, or whatever. There are certain times we all do it. You know, we've done it with teams like the Patriots and like the Spurs and like the Yankees over the years and on and on. If you're going to put them on a pedestal yourself and do that, and everybody hears it, then you have to eat the crow when the team struggles. I didn't put any of these teams up there. I'm not an expert in the NBA. I'm not an expert on pretty much a lot of things, but I didn't say that stuff about these teams. Now those very same people, and Neil, you can disagree with me if you want, those are the same people now putting these teams up in these lofty heights that are telling me that they're not good. I mean, am I wrong to feel that way about that?
No, I mean, you know, it's a pride thing. You know, a lot of people, that's how they got to where they are. You know, they're proud of who they are. They stick to their guns, and some people respect that, while others would prefer someone who's a little more humble. You know, me, it's I'm the first guy that, you know, I begrudgingly eat crow. I'm not one to say, oh, yeah, it was totally wrong, and, you know, whatever. But, you know, I think from this point on, though, it's best to just watch the games and make an opinion for yourself. You know, what's been tough for me is that trying to catch all the action is just out of control. I mean, the Bulls game started at like 11 o'clock last night or something like that. I mean, it's just been nuts trying to like keep up with it all, and the scheduling that's been going on has been. I need like 3 TVs to keep up. It's just nuts.
Yeah, I mean, I had texted Mike over the weekend because, as he knows, I'm not an NBA guy, but I was watching game one of the Brooklyn-Toronto series, and I was impressed. I really was. As someone who watches a lot of college hoops, as someone who loves defense and all the sports I watch, it was just one of those games where there was an intensity that was present that is never present in the regular season games I watch, which is what drove me away from being an NBA fan. I mean, I was a huge NBA fan growing up. And then it just got to the point where I said, you know what, most of these guys are just playing lazy. Most of them are selfish. A lot of that has to do nowadays with I'm forced to watch the New York Knicks. Carmelo, who ruins my love for the game a lot of times. But I watched that Toronto game, and I texted Mike and said, you know what, this is one of the best basketball games I've seen. And I think the final score was like 84-79 or something. And, you know, I'm not one of those guys that needs to see a game high-flying. I know the Clippers put up like a buck 40 the other night on Golden State. I'm not a guy who needs to see that kind of game. But good defense, both teams playing unselfish. DeMar DeRozan impressed the hell out of me. Love watching Joe Johnson play and those guys. And this is a team that, you know, Mike's been, you know, kind of, you know, pumping them up for a few months now, saying, you know what, don't sleep on the Nets. The Nets can do some things. They can make some noise. I know Toronto's not this unbelievable world-beating team, but they do have home court advantage. And here's the Nets just right in there playing hard with all that veteran experience. And then, of course, big shot Paul Pierce. There he is just contributing again. I mean, is this a team that you see, Neil, as someone that we should be getting on, or should we just be selling this team wholesale?
Well, I mean, you can see why the Nets made the moves for Garnett and Pierce. I mean, you know, the fact that Pierce had some, like, 4 or 5 points going into that fourth quarter, and then just he was a one-man show towards the end there. What surprised me was that KG's first 2 points came in the fourth quarter, that game one. You know, that's something that's just unusual to me. It just seems out of place. But, you know, that's why you got those guys, because they come up clutch when you need them most. Now, you know, you start to wonder as the series, you know, extends into the 5 and the 6 and the 7, if they can keep up, because the Raptors are the younger squad. You know, there's something there. I don't know. There's something there. I think they have a really good mix. I think everyone's kind of bought into Jason Kidd's system. And, you know, I mean, what's really surprising to me is that the fanaticism that's going on in Toronto. Yeah, it's unexpected to me, and maybe I'm just, you know, ignorant, but I didn't think that they could bring that kind of intensity and that kind of heat. I mean, they had like 5,000 people just hanging out outside the stadium watching the game. You know, they have their GM or their owner dropping F-bombs about the Nets, calling them dinosaurs. I mean, Toronto is bringing it, and it's good to see. And it makes it one of the more interesting series that are being played.
Yeah, you know, I honestly just think those are disgruntled Maple Leafs fans, to be honest. I think that town is so starving for winter this time of year. You know what I mean? Like, they put their hopes on the Blue Jays a couple times now with some big free agent signings. The Leafs haven't won a cup since 67. So, you know, I agree with you in the sense that that series is kind of getting heated up a little bit. And I'm going to tell you, just the team that I love to watch, and again, haven't watched a ton of the action. I've been really kind of enveloped in the NHL playoffs. But the San Antonio Spurs, to me and for my money, are undoubtedly the most fun team to watch. They just do everything right. And I see bits and pieces of that when I watched that Nets game against Toronto over the weekend, which was just a team that was willing to do all the tiny little things you had to do. And there they are. They're, you know, rife with veteran presence on their roster. So, I mean, I could see Brooklyn making a run, but do you see San Antonio, which is kind of how I feel now, even as much as I love Durant and what he's doing, I love the Clippers and the Warriors, but I see the Spurs being a team that's just dangerous. I mean, there's Popovich with another Coach of the Year award and a lot of veterans that know how to win. Is that a series you're interested in at all, Neil, watching them play the Mavericks?
I mean, you know, Mavericks from a couple of years ago maybe, but I just don't think they have the kind of firepower that they used to. You know, if it was the 2011 Mavericks, you know, I think this would be like a marquee matchup. But, you know, seeing where they are now and who they have and what's going on, it seems like it's going to be a pretty clean victory for San Antonio. And you have to wonder if you know, there's going to be anyone left standing with any kind of strength to give them a challenge, right? Because, I mean, the top contenders that we think about are the Thunder. You know, a lot of people like to say maybe the Rockets or the Clippers, you know, could step it up. But I don't – after looking at, you know, the Clippers in Game 1, and I didn't watch Game 2. I know they put up a tremendous amount of points. But in Game 1, they looked a little shaky. I mean, you had Blake Griffin, who only had, you know, a very low scoring output and a very low amount of minutes. I think he played like 19 minutes. Chris Paul was up and down, inconsistent. So, you know, what kind of Clippers are you going to get, you know, moving forward? Is it going to be the Game 1 or Game 2 Clippers? You know, and for some reason, I feel like the Grizzlies have got something going on that's really nice. I mean, I know they advanced pretty far last year, and they have some really quality players that seem to make clutch shots here and there. So, I mean, you know me. I'd like to see the Spurs ousted first round, clean sweep, but I just don't think the Mavs have it in them, and it's going to be a matter of, like, can the Clippers, Rockets, Thunder, can anyone really stick it to them from the standpoint where they're playing better fundamental basketball than San Antonio, and I don't know that anyone can do that.
What is up with the fact that you want to see San Antonio knocked out early? I want to know what's the negative side in San Antonio first.
Change the record. I mean, you can only take so much of these guys. It's the same thing in and out. It's like a machine. I'm a human. You know, I fear the rise of the machines, and the Spurs are machines. That's all they do. And, you know, when they mess up, it's a little reminder that we're all little human, and, you know, we can fear the machines rising for another day. But, I mean, like, I can't get behind them. And anyway, I can't support them. You know, last year the Spurs versus Heat in the finals was like, you know, like the Empire versus the, I don't know. I mean, name something evil, and it made me bonkers. So, I would like to see, you know, we've seen the emergence of the Clippers and the Thunder as potential challengers. But, you know, I want to see – I don't even know if I want to see the Thunder, because the Thunder, to me, are the most frustrating. You know, it's like we all know that Durant and Westbrook are really cool guys and everyone likes to support them, but it's like, you know, I don't know how much of their shtick I can take.
Well, I'm going to tell you why I don't have any problem with the Spurs, and it's just a quick little thing, but they do things right. You know what I mean? If it was an organization like Miami where it took three superstars to come from other places and kind of get together to create a winner, I'd change the record on them. Change the tune on them. The Spurs, to me, are what's good about the NBA, which is a team that plays a continuity offense. They spread it around. They're not just ISO-based. But if you want to really talk about changing the record, I'm going to bring up a guy's name that I just can't stand, and I'm so tired of hearing about him, hearing him open his mouth. And that's Dwight Howard, because this guy, to me, can put up as many double-doubles as he wants. And he's just another George Gervin-type player that puts up numbers, and you can't win with him. They lose the opening game to Portland, who I happen to think is a very good team. I know a lot of people agree with that, so I'm not going out on a limb there. They lose one game, and now Howard needs more touches, forgetting, I guess, that James Harden is the best player on that team. So now here he comes, just putting more holes in the dam like he always does, just plugging holes in it and then seeing who can fill them, and he's crying and moaning. Is there any reason that I should think, Mr. Lynch, that Dwight Howard needs to get a million more touches and they're supposed to kind of go away from this James Harden-based offense, which is what it is, and it's the reason they're there. I know he's a very good defensive player and all the things he does, but am I supposed to listen to this? And if so, for how long? How long am I supposed to listen to Dwight Howard ruin NBA franchises?
Well, I mean, a lot of people think that he's on the twilight of his career. He's on the decline, and you know, I'm surprised that you know that combination of Harden and Howard has worked to the way it has. You know, and I mean, if you're in that situation, do you want to sacrifice one game and risk it and say, you know what, first quarter we're coming out and it's all D Howard, just feed him the ball until you know you can make a decision. I mean, and I don't know that you want to do that. I don't know that you can do that with Harden, but you know, if they're keying on Harden, they know he's going to drive the hoop. Why not just go ISO with Howard for the first quarter and see how it pans out, and just say to Harden, hey, a little change in strategy. But you know, if it works, we'll stick with it. If it doesn't, we're coming back to you and you know, the offense will work off of you. But I don't know that you want to do that in the playoffs and sacrifice what could be, a huge opportunity to keep up with the other team. So, I mean, yeah, at some point it's like the squeaky wheel gets the grease. At some point you have a kid who's making too much noise and thinks he's the bomb. Then you got to be like, you know what? All right, here you go, Hoss. Here's the microphone. And then you see how it goes.
Yeah, and you know what? We're going to take a quick commercial break. But
is anyone out there?
We're going to take a quick commercial break. That was a little teaser right there for Ragnarok Rising. and I do agree with you, Neil. I just want to see Dwight Howard shut up. That's all I want. But we're going to be right back with the Tri-State Sports Guys.
Is anyone out there? This is the Nathaniel County Sheriff's Office. Is anyone out there? We were surrounded by the dead. They were in rioters, as we were told. We have survivors here. Civilians, women, children. Is anyone out there?
Follow the story in the Ragnarok Rising Saga by D.A. Roberts. Available on Amazon, Smashwords, Barnes & Noble, and BooksAMillion.com. Visit RagnarokRising.weebly.com.
We are back with the Tri-State Sports Guys. Neil Lynch, do you enjoy Ragnarok as much as I do?
I mean, I can't get enough of it. I've been patiently waiting for the movie to come out because I don't know how to read. So it would be great if they could just like fast track that, because I got my 3D glasses on. I'm hanging out at the IMAX waiting for this thing to hit the big screen.
I just find that it brings me a certain amount of joy to play that, and I don't know anything about Ragnarok. I've heard Mike talk about it, but you know, it's just one of those things that when we play it, I get happy. So I'm happy about it. But let's talk a little bit right now about the Blues and Blackhawks, Neil, because I know you mentioned to me today that you've watched some of it. I wrote a little article, more like a missive, a manifesto, about some of the things that I think are wrong with the National Hockey League. I'm going to assume you saw Brent Seabrook's hit on St. Louis captain David Backes. I just want your thoughts, Neil, on what you saw in that play. Did you think it was as egregious as they made it out to be, that it was this 3-game suspension? Did you agree with all that, Neil? Did you figure what I kind of figured, which is it was a hockey play, Backes kind of turned, and he got blown to pieces? What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you want to talk about overreaction and media frenzy or craze. I mean, there are some sites out there they were calling it one of the dirtiest hits in NHL history. You know, I've seen far worse than that hit. You know, I actually just watched the hit from 2010 by Matt Cook. I just saw it. It was on Reddit, where, you know, the guy's following through on a shot and is fully exposed, and, you know, Cook had him lined up from day one and just threw a vicious forearm right in the guy's face. I mean, part of me saw this play and was like, you know, Backes kind of, there was like a late movement downwards, and I think that's what you know, it was unfortunate. Like, it wasn't a situation where Backes is lined up and teed up and on a tee. And then, you know, Seaver comes in and just wobs him. I think there was some movement there, and, you know, it's still a pretty brutal hit. And, you know, but I do think there's a lot of overreaction over it.
The first thing is the National Hockey League is turning into the league that cares about who gets hit. Not how they got hit, who gets hit. Because if that hit happened to, you just mentioned him, and he's a lunatic, Matt Cook, if that hit happened to Daniel Carcillo or any number of those guys that kind of play on that fine edge, it's not even an issue. That's most of the time. That's not me making that up. That's kind of how it goes. It's viewed as so-and-so got it coming because he plays on an edge and he plays with some grit and he has what's coming. Yeah, he got what's coming to him. The thing that interested me with Backes is that's how Backes plays. The only difference is Backus is a talented two-way forward. He's not a goon. He's not a guy who drops his gloves at every turn. But if you remember back in 2010, leading up to the Vancouver Olympics, David Backus was skating around like a madman, trying to engage in fights with every player that was going to be representing Team Canada in the Olympics. And everybody forgets that now. And Seabrook, which apparently only the Chicago media mentions this, Seabrook isn't a guy who's even in question in terms of playing the game the right way. He's a big, tough kid. He's an extremely talented player. And I think if Backus doesn't turn just a little bit there, it's just probably 2 minutes for, I don't know, boarding, probably. It's not going to be checking from behind because then, like you said, he kind of turned, he kind of ducked a little bit, and whatever happened, happened. But what I found interesting, Neil, to get your opinion on the second part of it, is Milan Lucic in the Boston series skates up behind Red Wings young player, Danny Kaiser. He hits him right in the nether region with a stick from behind. Nobody saw it, okay? So they review it. He gets a $5,000 fine from the league office, which is without Brendan Shanahan now, who took over as president of the Leafs, okay? And not only does he do that to DeKaiser, he did it 2 weeks ago towards the end of the regular season to Alexei Yemelin up in Montreal. So this is a guy now with a track record. He gets a $5,000 fine. I love watching him play, but he is borderline dirty. And Seabrook gets 3 games. And Lucic gets $5,000. Is that something that you can explain to me as to how that's fair or right, or who the hell's up in Toronto reviewing these things?
Well, no, I agree. There's some favoritism there, and that's kind of been the way that sports goes. You know, it's I don't think it's just hockey that happens. You know, I think it's across the board, football, baseball, you name it. If there's a name player that has, brand marketing value, brand value, and can serve as the face of the league, they don't want to see that face tampered with or messed with. So there's definitely favoritism. But, I mean, let's get serious. There's been a concussion-type issue in the NHL. There hasn't been a guys losing their testicles issue in the NHL. So I don't know that you can put them, I mean, definitely a dirty hit for all the guys out there. They know, ooh, that stinks. But I don't know that you suspend a guy 3 games for it. I mean, you know, how long could the Red Wing player been out of commission? I mean, is he going to be holed up in a hotel while they find him a replacement, go Nats? I mean, it's a situation where they take the head stuff much more seriously than they do the other head.
You know, but my problem with that line of thinking is the fact that there comes a time where you have to review intent to injure. And to me, I understand that the cranium is far more dangerous than the other area. I get that. But to me, the idea that Lucic was not trying to injure DeKaiser speaks to the fact that I guess you can hit someone in that area and you're not trying to hurt them. I mean, when have you ever seen anyone get hit down there that wasn't by like a ball or a puck or something like that, where there wasn't intent? When someone swings a hockey stick and hits you there, they're trying to injure you. And that is what the National Hockey League, has tried to steer away from, that because they're trying to retain some of the fringe fans that they do have. Okay? It's not just guys like me that are going to watch no matter what they allow. It's the people that are willing to watch the Detroit-Boston game instead of the Tigers-Twins game. Those are the kinds of people that they're trying to hold on to. And when you allow a guy to just skate up behind someone and smash them up there in the junk, then to me it's like saying, you know what, we just don't care. Here's $5,000 we're going to fine you for a guy that makes almost $5 million a year. He's a frontline skater for the Bruins. That's fine. He's trying to injure him. There's no question about it. The question with Seabrook isn't quite that black and white. I mean, you could argue that. I could probably argue both sides of it. He was trying to hurt him. Okay, I'll argue that. He wasn't trying to hurt him. You can argue that. Only Seabrook knows. Everyone knows who saw Lucic smash this kid up there knows he was trying to injure him. So for the league to not give him a game, because I really think that should have been a game, and you give Seabrook a game, and everybody moves on. Because if you want to look back at the 80s, anything short of homicide didn't even land you a two-minute minor. You know, and I understand times change, but now you're getting into a situation where there's a whole lot of gray area about what is and what is not intent to injure. And the NHL has just kind of lost it. It's like they're not even paying attention. Shanahan left, and now nobody in Toronto knows what the hell they're doing. No one has any idea. everything's fine, suspend Seabrook, slap Lucic on the wrist. Wrong? Am I wrong?
Well, I don't know. Part of me feels like they, and this is totally not the way that a corporate office should be thinking, but that, you know, the possibly Detroit would want to want retaliation, and that retaliation will be equal to that of what happened, you know, prior. So if that makes any sense. So like with Seabrooks, it's like, okay, this right away, suspended. We don't want to see any of that kind of going on. But maybe they're kind of turning, you know, a blind eye to back to Lucic's kind of actions because they think that it will only do well for the series. It will only increase the interest. It will only increase the rivalry. And to have Lucic on the ice and with a bullseye on his nether regions, if you will add fuel to the fire for Detroit fans and for that team and, you know, possibly be like, you know, bulletin board material. I don't know. That's the conspiracy theorist in me is that, you know, they don't want to punish Lucic that bad because in all fairness, it didn't really make, you know, that much of a difference in the game and it won't in the series. So maybe there's incentive there to keep Lucic in the game because then that becomes a storyline. And then, you know, the Detroit's out to get him. But it's not to the point where they're headhunting and, you know, people are on concussion alert.
Well, let me ask you this, Neil, and then I just want to get into a little theory I have about the Flyers-Rangers series. But just to go back to this below-the-belt spearing situation, in a yes or no world, there's a suspension to Lucic if he does that to, say, Pavel Datsyuk or Nick Cronwall or even Gustav Nyquist, like one of the, you know, frontline players, the headline players for them with Zetterberg out. If he does that to Pavel Datsyuk, is he getting some kind of suspension for that game? Is he getting a bigger fine? Is it because the Kaiser's kind of a fringe player you don't think about him?
It's possible. You know, I think there's a chance. I mean, you know, if people, because there's more concern over that player versus the other, you know, there's more people that are affected by it. So, you know, I could see a higher fine, but I don't think that there would be a suspension as a result.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll never know, but it would be interesting. But my theory on the Flyers and the Rangers is, and again, I mean, I have a couple Rangers friends that I guess they think I'm some kind of homer. Because I'm an Islanders fan, I'm rooting for Philly, which isn't true. I mean, I really don't care who wins. You know, they both beat the hell out of the Islanders all the time. But when you watch that series, and I know you said today, Neil, you haven't seen a ton of it, you've been busy and all that. It's been a series like you would imagine it would be. It's been pretty physical. Nothing really over the top too much for, you know, for probably former Flyers and Rangers from 1975. They're going, what are these guys playing with skirts on? But the fact that New York has 16 power plays in three games to the Flyers' 9 in a series where both teams have been flying around, Daniel Carcillo has been like he's shot out of a lunatic rocket trying to frigging kill people. Boyle's had some hits. There was a check-in from behind the other night that he got away with. That was just, I guess it's fine. It's not a problem because it's him. So is it, in my mind, Neil, this is the question I'm getting to, I have tended to think that in the National Hockey League, they almost favor the larger market teams. Now, I watched it in the Montreal series. I saw all four games. They gave Montreal every break over Tampa because who wants to see Tampa in the second round outside of Tampa? I mean, I would rather see Montreal, and I don't even like them, but they're more interesting to watch. Is there anything to that, Neil? You know, I know, like I said, you haven't seen a lot of the series, but just in your mind, is there ever that edge they give to the bigger market team, in this case being the Rangers, where they're going to get every single call every time up and down the ice?
I mean, I don't even want to consider that. I really don't because, I think you really rule out, people say that with the NBA all the time as well. I mean, they say things are fixed, but it's like if it were truly fixed, wouldn't the Knicks be like, you know, somehow a 4 seed this year? I mean, you know, I think, NHL, as a whole, they definitely would want to see New York advance. But I don't think that's passed down to the referees, and I don't think that's a case where that's really a plan of action. You know, I think it comes down to, you know, the Flyers have been kind of notorious for leading league in penalty minutes. And, you know, especially, you know, knowing that their starting goalie is out with an injury, they're probably willing to take more more riskier chances to keep the puck away from their zone. So, I mean, to me, though, like, that whole Canadiens-Lightning series flew so completely under the radar, it was ridiculous. Like, it's the first game started last week on our show, and before you blink of an eye, the Canadiens have swept. It was just ridiculous. And, you know, I think the Tampa Bay put up a pretty decent fight that last game, but, you know, I wasn't totally interested in that series heading in, and then I completely missed on it and whiffed on it once it was all said and done. But, you know, quickly going back to the Rangers game, I mean, you want to talk about, okay, so the play is not as physical as a lot of people would have wanted, but the end of that Rangers-Flyers game where I forget who it was, Zuccarello, whoever, goes over to the glass, and you have the Philly fan, double fingers blazing hot in his face.
It was
that was just like, I mean, that's why I watch. I mean, the intensity and, like, just the extreme hate that these two franchises have for each other, I mean, that's what I'll tune in for.
Yeah, I mean, that was a deal where, you know, he serves, first of all, he served the bench penalty. They put him in there, which is understandable. Most teams do that because he's not really on their penalty kill at any point. So he serves that. He gets out. He gets a hit. He's back in the box now for his own, you know, his own actions. And the place there is going nuts. The Wells Fargo Center is going nuts. He's a former Flyer, and, you know, he's got that label of being easy to hate if he's not on your team. He gets out of the box, joins the rush, scores a goal. And you're right. That is why people watch the playoffs, is to see kind of that friction between two clubs that historically have not liked each other. And I think they haven't played in the playoffs since 97. Or it's 15, 17 years, something like that. I can't remember what it is, but they haven't played in ages in the playoffs. So now it's like these people are getting it out of their system. With regards to Montreal, I mean, I love to watch Montreal, and I cannot stand them. I can't stand their fans. I can't stand the uppity nature that they talk down to the rest of the league for having 24 cups, like about 20 of them they won, but there's only six friggin' teams, so you got to listen to them. But there's just something about the Bell Center. I've never been there, but there's something about it on TV. It's just cool. And when a game is there, it's cool. And I did think about what you just said about that series kind of flying under the radar. And I think in my mind, it was like, it's because it started in Tampa. And who the hell wants to watch a hockey game in Tampa Bay? You know what I mean? Like, they start down there. Montreal's the better team, but they're not the better seed. They're in Tampa. No one cares. There were empty seats down there at the Forum. And then they go up to Montreal, and then the series just ticked into gear. Both teams were playing like maniacs. But that was a series that I was hoping to watch more of. And then to your point, Neil, it's over. I mean, I go to my softball game last night. I come back, the series is over. Really? I mean, it was that fast. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, it lines it up for Canadiens-Bruins matchup, which I think a lot of people are pulling for. So it's not like a huge bummer, but it was, you know, but right as I start to pay attention to it, it's like it's done. So it's just really interesting how that plays out. And, you know, as far as the other series go, like, I was really, you know, as I'm pouring through the highlights, just trying to catch up on everything, the atmosphere in Dallas, you know, you don't really think of Dallas being a strong, hardcore hockey town. And, you know, you listen to the volume that they got going on in that arena when they score and when they got opportunities to break it open, it's like, it's borderline pandemonium. So that was really interesting to see how the Stars, you know, really played with more intensity and just flew around quicker based on their crowd.
Yeah, that is. That's a young team. They play hard. They got a lot of parts down there. And people forget who won the Cup in 99, and people just treat it like it never happened. I mean, Buffalo, where they gave Brett Hull that goal and all that stuff. But that is a town, fortunately, that when they're in contention, people are there. People fill the arena when the Stars are good down there. It's a good sports town. You know, we like to kill on them up here because of the Cowboys and all these different things. It's a good sports town. We are going to take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, we're hoping to have two-time major champion Mr. John Daly join us.
These days, my dollar just doesn't go as far. In my car, it gets me about 6 miles. On my cell phone, maybe 4 minutes. But at McDonald's, my dollar gets me through the entire day. From sausage McMuffin with egg for breakfast to a tasty double cheeseburger. Thanks to McDonald's Dollar Menu, my dollar gets me right where I want to be. Satisfied.
And we are back. Neil, let's get into a little bit of discussion here. You know, you and I broke down the Masters probably better than any two guys in the history of sports radio. And we're about to be joined by a man who's won a couple of major championships. I mean, talk a little bit about your memories of watching John Daly over the years.
Well, I mean, you know, growing up, my grandfather was extremely into golf, as was my grandmother, kind of by association. But, you know, there was kind of like a certain character that, you know, certain stigma that golf had, where it was very buttoned up, and, you know, it was, you had this kind of look, and you had this kind of game, and, you know, this is the way you behave, and rules, 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 rules. And then a guy like John Daly comes along, and you're like, it's a breath of fresh air, because, like, I'm kind of a guy that...
You
like,
want to know something, Neil? You want to know something, bud? We are joined by that very man right now. We are going to go out to the Tucci Lumber Hotline, where we are joined by one of our favorite golfers of all time here at the Tri-State Sports Guys and a two-time major champion, Mr. John Daly. John, are you with us?
I am. How y'all doing?
We're doing great. We really appreciate you joining us on a Wednesday night. We know you're a busy man. We got into some Masters breakdown the last couple weeks, and you're a perfect guy to talk to about it, because we talked a little bit about Bubba Watson reminding us of the kind of game that you played. You know what I mean? Hitting those big bombs, being out there in front of everybody. Now he joins you in the rarefied era of being a two-time major champion. What are your thoughts on Bubba? Because, you know, we talked about him in terms of maybe one more major. The guy's a Hall of Famer. I mean, you know, he's come out of nowhere. You came out of nowhere back in 91. Talk a little bit about Bubba.
Well, it just proves that, you know, self-taught athletes can make it out here. I was self-taught. I never had a teacher. I don't think Bubba really ever had a coach growing up. And, you know, the greatest thing about Bubba is his length and the feel that he has around the greens. And that's how I won tournaments. As you get older, you lose a little feel, but he's still young. So, Love is somebody that the fans love to watch, and he hits it a mile. But the bottom line is the guy can chip and putt. That's what wins tournaments.
Yeah,
John,
you know,
this is Neil Lynch, the Tri-State co-host. So was it a situation growing up where you know, something felt right with your swing, and you decided to go with it? Or was it, did you have any backing from someone else being like, don't listen to whoever, go with what feels right? Was there like a definitive point where you made that decision, or is it just something that you kind of went with?
Well, I grew up on a little 9-hole golf course. Didn't really have a sand trap. So the way I learned how to hit out of bunkers was on a baseball field from the pitcher's mound and stuff like that. But the only people that told me never to change my swing are the people that I grew up around in Dardanelle, Arkansas. But when I'd leave Dardanelle, college coaches said, you won't play on my team unless you change your swing. You'll never make it out here. You never make it big in golf if you don't change your swing. And I don't know, one, at that young, if I could have changed it. And two, I think it was more of me just saying, hey, I'm going to prove you wrong. And, you know, I'm not the most consistent player, you know, that's ever played the game of golf. But, you know, I think I've done okay. And I don't think I could have won two majors or won any golf tournaments if I didn't have the long backswing and all that, because it was the only way I knew how to play. You know, it'd be like trying to change, you know, Joe Theismann when he played college football, try and change the way he threw the football going into the pros. It just wasn't going to happen. And he won a Super Bowl. So, you know, I think if you keep believing in yourself, look at Arnold Palmer's golf swing. Look at Jim Furyk's golf swing. I mean, you know, even Bubba's. Bubba's off balance, but he's really not because his hands are in control. In golf, your hands and feet are supposed to be in control, but, you know, if you look at Bubba's swing, his hands overtake his whole golf swing, and that's why he's so good, because he's got the feel. So I just didn't listen to anybody. When I wanted to get some confidence in my game, I'd go back to Dardanelle because everybody told me, you know, don't change a thing. And these, a lot of these people can play a little golf at home. There's not many people in my town, but a lot of them aren't that great of golfers, but they give me that self-confidence that I need to go back on the road.
So what is your take on the 20-year-old Jordan Spieth? You've seen him play, hopefully. Is this a guy that you think has a long future ahead of him, or is it kind of a flash in the pan?
No, he's been playing phenomenal this year. He's been playing almost like Matt Kuchar's been playing this year. I mean, the guy's solid. He's top 10 in it a lot. He almost won the Masters. You know, that's being his first Masters to almost win it. That can only build confidence for someone like Jordan or for anybody that's in that situation. You know, and he's just going to learn from it. And Jordan Spieth is a guy that's going to be around a long time, no doubt. He's got great, great talent and a great, great short game.
Now, you know, a lot of people have said that with Tiger out due to injury and Phil not making the cut, that contributed a lot to the ratings dropping significantly for the Masters. You know, a lot of people say that golf needs Tiger and Phil in order for it to be competitive in terms of, you know, viewers and audience. Do you think that there's a John Daly in the field? Do you think there's a future John Daly who can maybe ruffle a few feathers and make things interesting again?
You know, in all sports, somebody always comes out. It doesn't matter. Somebody always comes out sooner or later that, I don't know if anybody's ever going to be able to do what Michael Jordan did in basketball. I don't think anybody's ever going to do what Tiger did on that run, you know, in the early 2000s to 2008. But I do believe it can happen. And, you know, Tiger definitely moves the needle an awful lot when he plays in a golf tournament. There's no doubt. And the ratings probably were down. You know, me being at Hooters the whole week and selling merchandise and meeting the people and having a good time and all that, I can say it wasn't quite as busy as previous Masters were. But, you know, that's to Tiger's credit, actually. He doesn't play. I don't think the ratings are as good. But the tournament ended up good because it was pretty close, you know, through about 69 holes. Bubba kind of had it with 3 holes left. But, you know, it was a good... It was a good tournament. It was. I didn't watch much of it. I just heard about it, and you know. But Tiger definitely moves the needle in a big, big way when he plays.
So how did things go at Hooters? What was your experience like there? Were sales good?
Sales were good. You know, my John Daly original cocktails are in Georgia now, and they sold a bunch of them at Hooters. We're actually in y'all state in Connecticut with Ace Distributing as our distributor, and the sales were great. It was a good week. Monday especially when I ran out of t-shirts almost the first day because they closed the course at 9:30, had everybody leave the golf course, and right off the fourth hole, that par three, there's a gate. People were rushing to Hooters to get out of the rain, and we were selling in the rain with my awnings out, and everybody's buying t-shirts, going at Hooters, and drinking my drink and eating at Hooters and getting dried off. It was a good Monday, I know that.
Well, I got an interesting story for you. My sister, her anniversary of her wedding, her 3-year anniversary is today. She got married in 2011, and she asked me back when she was getting married, what kind of cocktails do you want to serve? And I said, well, number one on the list has got to be the John Daly. And lo and behold, it was the most popular drink at our reception, and it ended up well for all of us. So I'll put it that way.
Oh, cool. Well, now you just poured out of the John Daly bottle. It's just the John Daly original cocktail bottle. We have sweet tea lemonade. We have raspberry, and we have peat, and it's going really good. We're getting in a lot of states, and it's starting to make a move.
Well, I'm all for that. Now, what can you tell us about this loudmouth clothing?
It's amazing. It's just getting bigger and bigger, and we're coming out with more and more patterns pretty much every 3 to 6 months. Woody's bringing in probably 6 to 8 new patterns, it seems like, every 3 to 6 months, and it's going really, really strong, and I'm just proud to be with them. We're a fun company, and as our slogan says, it's the most fun you can have with your pants on. So we're having a good time with it.
I'm definitely all for that. I mean, that's one of the things that I do pay attention to, because I'm such a hack golfer, is the clothing that the guys are wearing out there on the fairway, because it makes a statement. And I've definitely rolled up into a couple bars wearing some nice looking pants that are on par with the loudmouth pants, and it definitely to open some eyes and start some conversations. So I definitely need to check that out. Dan, did you have any more questions?
Yeah, I just want to get John, this is Dan again. I just want to get your take on all the equipment changes and the belly putters, the kind of balls the guys are using now, the clubs, all those kinds of things. We had Hank Haney on a few weeks ago, and he just kind of said that the game's getting away from itself a little bit. Is that something you agree with, or are you fine with everything that these guys are using now?
Yeah, I think it's getting away a little bit, I think, especially with the golf ball. And I think the USGA and R&A and the head honchos of the rules of golf, which they are, need to eliminate the size of the drivers. I think they need to come down an awful lot. They need to be a lot smaller. I think they're too forgiving. And then when you put a golf ball that just goes a long way, no matter who hits it, it seems like now, I think the technology is absolutely ruining the game of golf. It's making golf courses and golf tournaments that we play in, people, the members and stuff at some of these private courses we play tournaments on are trying to figure out a way to make the courses longer, which costs their club more money, which they got to assess their members more money. It's getting crazy. It's getting out of hand. And, I don't know. I don't think the belly putter to me is something that should go away. I've never really believed it should go away. I think if you're going to knock the belly putter out, you need to get the hybrids out. The hybrids are the most cheating golf clubs made. And, I mean, you can hit them out of the rough. You can, but for me, I can't hit them because I can't – they go too high, they go too far. But for an amateur, which buys a ton of them, and a lot of the tour players play the hybrids because they're trying – they don't feel as comfortable with a 2 and 3 iron like I still hit. And it's not just the belly putter that needs to go away. I feel the hybrids need to go away. The drivers need to get smaller. The golf ball needs to come back and be softer where it doesn't go as far. But that's just my opinion. I mean, I think there's a lot of guys that might say the same thing, and a lot of guys may argue that point with me. But I remember Nicklaus, when I was playing really good in the 90s and stuff, he was talking about how the technology is getting out of hand. And to me, I agree with him. I think it's way out of hand now.
John, I mean, my last question for you. I've heard players like Bernard Langer, Tim Clark, Kevin Stadler mention things along the lines of that when the band comes into place, that they don't even know what they're going to do. They say it as though they're going to become like these vagabonds that don't know where to go. They're going to almost quit the game. Is that the direction you see it going for for major champions like Keegan Bradley, Adam Scott, Ernie Els, guys that use the belly and the long putters and all that, do you think these guys are just going to disappear from the radar in the golf world?
No, I think if they're hard and stubborn like I am, and they all got unbelievable talent, that they have to adjust. It's taken me 4 years, 5 years to adjust to the V grooves and the wedges. You know, I'm a guy that never really has spun the ball a ton, and I've had to revamp my whole short game in order to try and get real consistent with the ball bouncing and rolling instead of hitting once, skipping and stopping. So I think as talented as those guys are, they can make that change. And I believe they can. Adam Scott's a Masters winner. He's won multiple tournaments. It shouldn't be that difficult for him, but it's like your mind plays tricks on you. If you believe you're not going to putt great without a belly putter, you're not going to putt great. So I don't think the belly putter is that big of a deal. I just believe those guys can come back and putt with anything. I've seen Tim Clark putt. I've seen Ernie Els win majors and golf tournaments without the belly putter. So I think it depends on the person. If they can convince themselves that they're going to be great putters without the belly putter, then they'll be great putters. If they think they're never going to play good golf again, then your mind plays tricks on you and they won't play good golf.
John, our producer just threw one at us. He's curious to know, because he's a big fan of yours, 200 yards out, what are you hitting into the green in normal conditions? He wants to know the club in your hands. What are you hitting for 200 out?
It's a normal 5-iron. Just a nice, solid 5-iron.
I'm hitting that hybrid club that you wanted to ban there, John.
Yeah, I've gone down. I'll be 48 years Monday. My 5-iron used to be 210 to 215. So as you get older, trust me, the yards go, it goes quickly.
Well, John, listen, we thank you for joining us. We wish you a happy birthday. We don't get many two-time major champions around here. You can check you out on loudmouthgolf.com and look up Original John Daly Cocktails. They're served right here in Norwalk, Connecticut at 99 bottles. You can check that out down by Vet Park. And again, John, we really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You got it, guys. And good luck with the station. Keep it going.
Thank you very much.
You got it.
That was the great John Daly. I mean, we don't get many people like that around here. We've had some phenomenal guests. You can name them. Gary Rice, Ernie Banks, Tommy John, on and on. We've had some great ones. That was cool for me, and I know you're a big fan. So how cool was that for you? First of all, and the other thing, let's get on the same page next time, buddy, because, I mean, I was a little confused. I know you're a former relief pitcher. You're throwing me curveballs on a 2-0 count. I don't know what's going on over here.
Yeah, I just, I got a little excited, and I want to split. We need to have, like, a weekly segment with John. I feel like he's just gold. I mean, I would love to split a case of Diet Coke with him. I don't know how I'd be able to keep up, but I would try my best.
Well, I'll tell you something. I have argued for a long time, and I didn't want to gush because I'm not going to, compare our John Daly fanhood, to one another. But I have argued with people over the years that this is a guy who, he's the only two-time major champion never to appear on a Ryder Cup side. And, I mean, at his age now, it's probably a long shot, but he gets no credit. And you were talking to him a little bit about, the off-the-course type of personality that he is. But this is a guy where, I mean, Ben Crenshaw is gold. He's golfing gold. And I love Crenshaw. And so Olafable and Langer and all those guys are two-time major champions. They're solid gold. Johnny Miller. This guy is like persona non grata. It's so upsetting for me, a blue-collar kid. He's like one of the good guys. And he's had some off-the-course issues. But should the guy be persecuted for that? Or should he not be up there in the same standing as those other guys I just mentioned?
Yeah, and I mean, it's sad that we tend to group people like that. I mean, the fact that, it's been noted that John smokes a ton of cigarettes and drinks a lot of Diet Coke and he likes to drink and he likes to live, the fast life. I mean, if that's what you want to call it. But, I mean, to me, golf needs more personalities like that. You know, like before we got to talking to him in my intro, it was, you know, it's something different, something unique. It's someone who, I mean, you can see, I mean, self-taught swing. He doesn't like the technology that's coming out. He wants to get back to basics and get back to, you know, really making the playing field level in a way, and really having, you know, your game and your talent speak for you instead of your club. So, you know, I mean, golf could use more of him and not less. And it's you know, it might be a situation where he didn't get along with the top brass or whatever, but I'd like to think that a part of Billy Madison was inspired by his play, you know. And, you know, next time you see me, I might be all decked out in loudmouth clothing. I think that stuff's legit, and I might be able to pull it off.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Commissioner Fincham, now the head of the PGA, and David Faye before him and these guys, I mean, these are the prototypical, like, Bushwood golfers out of Caddyshack. I mean, that's the kind of guys that are the mouthpieces for these organizations, like the PGA, like the USGA. And you know what? I get so tired of it because golf is such a cool game. I stink at it, but it's such a fun game, and it's so cool to watch the guys that are good. And then somebody like Daly comes along, who is such an original. I mean, he really is, in every sense of the word, he is original, and he is especially original for that game. And he's a guy that, like, they throw him to the wayside, and they just don't care. They forget the fact. I mean, this is an alternate that won the PGA. He's won, and Jack Nicklaus said it, you're not a golfer until you win at St. Andrews. He wins the Open Championship St. Andrews in 95 in a playoff over Constantino Rocca, which was epic. And he's just not even considered. I mean, I think he's got 8 wins, including the European Tour, and he's just forgotten about. And I think it's sad, and I think it's something that the PGA Tour and the USGA and everybody else and the RNA, I know he has that pass to the Open Championship until he's 60, I believe it is, the exemption into there. They should talk about this guy more because there's not a whole lot of golfers. I think there's like 6 that have won Open Championships at St. Andrews. And for me, and I know you're excited too about it, it was a cool opportunity, man, to talk to a guy like that. He's a big name in golf.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to he's human. You know, he makes mistakes, and I think that's what appeals to a lot of people, like me at least, is that, you know, he has his demons like we all do. But he also is not afraid to keep plugging away, keep trucking, and to make the most of it, and to, you know, live life to its fullest, and be damned for thinking of me and judging me in a certain way. You know, I'm going to live the life that I want to live. So, you know, I mean, a lot of worse people you could look up to or, you know, follow. So, I mean, that's my 2 cents. I didn't get to ask him about the when he drove the golf ball out of the woman's mouth. I don't know if you got a chance to see that, but the woman put a golf ball on a tee, was lying down, and Daly just lined it up and drove it right out of her mouth. I mean, it's like, you know, the fact that he's still doing that kind of stuff at 47 is just, and soon to be 48, is ridiculously awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I saw him last year. He was on an episode of Faraday on the Golf Channel, which is one of my favorite shows. And he had Faraday lie down, put the tee in his mouth, and he just pumped a 330-yard driver down the middle of the fairway. I mean, that's the kind of guy you're dealing with here. And, you know, it's perfect because Faraday's got some nuttiness to him too. And he just got laid. I mean, I'm not letting anybody hit a golf ball out of my mouth like that. I don't care if he's got 2 majors. If you're not hitting a golf ball out of my mouth, I'm terrified. You know what I mean? So you're just not doing it. And, you know, that's the cool thing about him, though, is his willingness to just be a regular guy. So, you know, we had the opportunity to talk to him. It was tremendous. And, you know, Neil, we're not going to take a commercial break right now. We're just going to make a terrible segue with 2 words. And I think it's going to be something that's going to be right in your wheelhouse. And those 2 words, and I wanted to wait for Mike, but can't hold out on it, are Ike Davis. I just want to talk about Ike Davis because I said for weeks now, I'm not even a Mets fan, he was the expendable one. Satin and Duda are better than him. They get rid of him. He hits a grand slam in the night in Pittsburgh. He's probably going to become a Hall of Famer now that he's not playing at Citi Field anymore. What were your thoughts on the Davis trade as a Mets fan?
Well, immediately, thought, all I saw was the Mets trade Ike Davis, and I said, beautiful. Exactly what I wanted. I didn't even care who it was that they got in return. You know, and because I feel like they invested way too much time in him in hoping that he would pull it around or pull out of the tailspin or what have you. And some people are just not cut out to play in New York or much less Citi Field. And I guess Ike was one of them. I don't understand why people get down on Duda. You know, I don't think he looks as bad as Davis at the plate sometimes. And you can see Duda had another home run tonight. He has four so far. So I think he's doing well, and I think he's going to do well. You know, many people looked at Duda last year when Ike went down, and he got pretty much the bulk of the playing time at first base, and he didn't really perform. But guess what, guys? That was September in a season that was lost. You know, I don't want to say that he didn't try his best, but I don't think there's that same feeling that, oh, yeah, the job is mine now, because Ike was hurt, and there's always the possibility that Ike comes back and that they go with him again. So when I first saw Mets trade Ike Davis, I don't want to say ecstatic, because you never want to say that about anyone, but it was like relief. It was like, all right, thank God we were able to deal him. And then once I was able to, like, process it, it was like, all right, well, who would we get? And then I see who they get, and I'm like, all right, a minor leaguer, minor league pitcher, a right-hander, okay, I guess. And then I come to find out it's this guy, Zach, and then it's a player to be named later, which, you know, 9 times out of 10, the player to be named later, I don't know what you consider it. It's like the washing machine that they traded for in semi-pro. Like, what does that mean? It's never someone of any significance. And then the broadcast team for the Mets, Gary Cohen, Ron Darling, Keith Hernandez, keep saying that, oh, it's a player of significance. It's going to be a very significant player. So it's a very interesting twist to that trade, because I thought it was a one-for-one type deal. But apparently this player to be named later could be significant. Is it going to be a game changer? I don't know. I mean, they could use some help in several areas. But it's just good to see that they were able to alleviate the first base situation, because it's been a topic of conversation for way, way too long.
Well, I'll tell you what, Neil. You and I are a couple of amateurs. We're going to go out right now to an expert Mets fan on the Tucci Lumber Hotline, the one and only Bobo. Bobo, what do you have for us tonight, buddy?
Yeah, everything. First of all, I have to say I'm kind of still iffy about that Ike Davis trade, because I kind of felt he was going to come around, and I also do remember him back when he played for the Cyclones back in the day.
I don't remember that.
But that's how far back I go.
Well, tell me this, Bobo. Were you happy to see him go? Did you feel like they got market value for him? What were your thoughts on the trade of Pittsburgh?
I don't know that he got anything back for him. I was hoping they would trade him and get back a shortstop at least.
Right.
I agree with you there, because, I mean, the play of the Mets shortstop, that position that has been lackluster, you know, I think they've kind of bolstered the outfield with Granderson and Chris Young. And Lagares is coming into his own, even though he's hurt now. And then you look at the infield, you know, second base is short up with Murphy. Wright is solid at third. It looks like Darnell might be coming out of a slump behind the plate. But he's still got that shortstop position. And I just do not believe in Ruben Tejada. He's not the kind of player that we thought he was going to be, because at first, his first couple of seasons, he's hitting the ball. He's taking pitches. He's working the count. He's pretty solid in defensively with the glove. And then all of a sudden this year, it's like there's a play at the plate, and he doesn't know whether to slide or bowl the catcher over, so he didn't know the rule there. And then tonight, there's a chance for a double play, and he's completely baffled as to what to do with the ball. And, you know, despite when Tejada went down and Quintanilla was able to come up and perform well, I don't think Quintanilla is the answer either. So, yeah, I'm with you on that one, Bobo. I was hoping for a shortstop as well.
Yeah, I know. I can also blame for all that because Reyes went out with a hamstring over at Toronto. Otherwise, I think if it got to the right point, it wouldn't surprise me if Reyes comes back to New York, comes back to Flushing.
Yeah, I know there's been some rumblings about that, but I honestly think it's a bad move You know, I think he's past his prime. You know, we saw the best of him when he was in a Mets uniform. That hamstring has been an issue for him his entire career, and I don't see it getting any better. And, you know, to be honest, I mean, unless the Mets make some kind of push towards the end of the season and the Blue Jays are willing to deal him for very little to nothing, I just don't see it happening. You know, I think Mets fans would be open to it and might even be happy about it, but I think you're asking for trouble by bringing him back.
True, also, I gotta say, this weekend is that big birthday get together at McFadden's this weekend.
Oh, that's right. It's this weekend. It's this Saturday.
Yep, this Saturday afternoon before the game.
Oh my God, I wish I could make it. I have a going away party for my roommate who's moving into the city, so I got to send him off the appropriate way. Otherwise, I'd be there. But you said it's going to be at McFadden's, and are you going to be dancing on the bar at McFadden's?
I don't know about that. All right, that's reserved for any female to do that.
Well, I mean, I don't understand why they're not going to have a nice on-the-field celebration for you, or, you know, a little pregame action on the mound or something like that. Are you sure you're not throwing out the first pitch?
I'm sure I'm not. But like I said, Mike, you're welcome to be there.
Yeah, no, thank you for the invite. I mean, what's your take so far? Do you think the lineup that they have right now in place, is this – a solid lineup? Do you think if they can stay healthy, that they can threaten in the NL East?
Yeah, I think they could. They could do that as long as our pitching holds up. And if Colombo doesn't pitch like he's been eating the entire Shake Shack.
Well, I mean, one of the most entertaining storylines this year has been Bartolo Colon and the way that he bats. I mean, he just looks completely out of place up there. And it's now become a show in and of itself when he gets steps into the batter's box, that's for sure. But, you know, with Parnell going down, a lot of people had some confidence in Valverde that he would be the closer of yore, and that didn't turn out to be the case. And now Farnsworth is the closer. What is your take on Farnsworth?
Well, I know right now, at least until the situation gets better, it feels like it's going to be one of those days where every time it's 19, I'm going to be nervous.
Yeah, I was pretty nervous. I think it was last night or the night before when they're up 2-0 and he had to get a bulk of the outs heading into that save opportunity. You know, it to me, it doesn't look like he has a ton of control, so that's definitely a concern. But, you know, as long as he's able to shore it up and lock it down, I guess we're going to have to live with it for now.
Guess what's up? We'll have to do with everything but the air and everything but the kitchen sink bullpen.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting to the point where I'm loosening up my arm, and I got a cortisone shot at the doctor, and, you know, I'm going to start running pretty soon, so maybe, you know, my number will get called. But I know there's a line out the door willing to be the closer for this team, because it seems like they got a starting rotation that's keeping it together, and, you know, who knows come down the stretch. But is there a game you're looking forward to on the schedule coming ahead? Because I know, you know, this is a pretty big series with the Cardinals. It looks like they're winning tonight, and they might be able to take that series. But is there a series you're looking forward to?
Well, one of the series that I got tickets to two games during a Subway series.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that should be interesting because, you know, we didn't talk about Tanaka tonight yet, but it seems like at the weekly thing, Tanaka Tuesday, where he comes out and he just is lights out. I mean, he's throwing, you know, his split finger is just untouchable at this point, and he's pretty much living up to the hype, and he's I wouldn't say he's worth the money because it's just astronomically absurd, but so far so good for Tanaka. Do you get a chance to watch him pitch, or do you watch the Yankees at all? What's your take?
I don't really see the Yankees that much, mostly from what I hear about in a paper or online, because being a Mets fan, I'm usually watching my Mets, but I hear rumblings from some friends and relatives that are Yankee fans. I've been hearing rumblings here and there, especially from a friend of mine around the corner from me.
Yeah, it's interesting because they got Jacoby Ellsbury, who a lot of people were wondering how the Boston faithful were going to react to him coming into the stadium, it's interesting. It's like Ellsbury's not very an outspoken guy. He's kind of to himself. He just goes out there and plays a steady game, And now the Mets sign. You want to talk about rivals and teammates trading sides. The Mets have brought up Bobby Abreu. What is your opinion on that?
I'm not sure what the belief is. I think at this point he's just more of a pinch hitter and a guy that'll be mostly pinch hitting on the bench most of the time. It seems like what year is this? It would be a big deal a few years ago, 15 years ago maybe.
Well, I was making a joke to a couple coworkers at the office. I was saying that we should bring back Chipper Jones and we should bring back Pat the Bat, Pat Burrell, and just throw them all out there and see if they can light it up like they used to against us.
that's what it feels like. But I'm actually going to the Subway Series. I'm going to the Monday game in the Bronx, and I'm going to the Wednesday game. Thanks to buying the tickets through the 7 line.
Yeah, no, that's a great site, and they have some great promotions. I know that we went to a game last year, in April, courtesy of the 7 line. We sat in center field. It was against the Nationals, I believe, and we had an awesome time. The whole section was, fans of the 7 line.
I think I'm familiar with that game because my sister actually was part of the group singing the national anthem that day.
Oh wow! Now, are you a singer, Bobo? Can you belt out a couple chords?
I'm not really much of a singer, except for maybe a few times at the compound. I have a little karaoke at the compound. I have.
Oh, nice! What's your go-to song on karaoke?
Oh, there's a few that I go to, but one of mine that I've often gone to is "Fight for Your Right to Party," being that of a Beastie Boys fan.
Oh yeah, I mean that's just clutch. I personally like to go with a little GNR, a little Guns N' Roses, some November Rain to bring down the house, but definitely Beastie Boys is in the mix.
Yeah, but I've actually been bummed out. I never got to see them live when MCA died. They bummed me out. I never got to see them live.
We'll take a quick break.
We'll be right back. We got Scott Farrell calling in a minute. We're Tri-State Sports Guy.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Golf Tournament Quiet Sign Holder Upper.
Mr. Golf Tournament Quiet Sign Holder Upper.
Boldly you patrol the line between order and anarchy, armed with only your wits, your resolve, and your tiny cardboard sign stapled to a stick.
Actually, I glued it on.
You protect professional golfers from what they fear most. Idle chit-chat 200 yards away.
Stop breathing so loud now.
Because you know there's one thing this spectator sport could really do without. Spectators.
Get them out.
So crack open an ice cold Bud Light, oh Sultan of the Shush. We'll keep singing your praises as long as you keep telling us to shut up.
Mr. Golf Cinnamon Quiet Sign Holder.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
Hey, we're back. It's the Tri-State Sports Guys. It's Mike DePalma next to Danny Sunshine over here. We call him Danny Tutin. Hey, Neil, what's going on? What did I miss today? You talked to John Daly, Bobo. What's going on?
It's been pandemonium. It's been madness. We pretty much crushed the NBA playoffs. I don't know that anyone can do it better than me and Santa talking professional basketball. And then Santa pretty much took the reins. Yeah, I mean, we would love your take on how the Mets are doing right now. I don't know if you have it in you.
I'll give you a little Mets, and then I'll give you a little breaking Michael Pineda news as we go along. But how I think the Mets are doing, it's like smoke and mirrors, man. They beat 10-10 right now. They're winning right now 3-1 last I saw. I mean, they don't have anybody hitting in that lineup with any kind of consistency.
Wrecker.
They got your boy Wrecker, Danny's best friend Wrecker. But you know what? And I know people, I'm a big basher of Terry Collins, and people want to give credit to Terry Collins. If they had a decent manager, they could have 13, 14 wins under his belt right now, the way he handles the bullpen. How many times have they led in 17 of the 20 games, and they only won 10 of them? These guys are scrappers. I'm telling you, they put together a little team. You get these guys that came up together. I think that there's a lot to be said with the fact that a lot of these guys on the team right now played under Wally Backman together. They played together coming up. I think there's a lot to be said about that, honestly. And then you look at Mejia, the way his ball's moving, he's kind of going to be the odd man out. I love the fact that Dice K's in the pen. I think before too long, Dice K's going to be the closer. And I think he could almost have a little renaissance in his career as a closer. Even though I know he's wild at times, and you know, he throws a lot of pitches, I think if he's focused in on one inning, I think he could be a future closer for the Mets. I swear to God. What do you think, Neil?
You know what? Never say never. A lot can happen. I mean, you know, anything can happen. So I'm not ruling it out. And I know Farnsworth just makes me really uncomfortable. And, you know, I know you put a lot of emphasis on Collins, too, but, I mean, Granderson just got his first hit in 22 at-bats. The guy was 0-for-3 the other night with 3 Ks. How much longer do you let Granderson go? I know it's April, and part of me wants to say just let April play itself out. Maybe he'll get it out of the system. But, I mean, at some point you got to say, is this another Jason Bay that we signed up for?
Yeah, I think, honest to God, you give a guy 4 years, what was it, $60-some-odd million? He gets into the All-Star break, to be honest. I mean, in a perfect world, even if money wasn't an option, with his track record, he gets a minimum of 100 at-bats, minimum, before you even start thinking about anything. I mean, a guy that's had an extended career like that, you know, don't forget, missed a lot of time last year, got injured this year, might take him a little while to get going. I don't think he's going to be a Jason Bay. I honestly don't. And as much as I am a realist, I think at times about some of these, and I'm not a big fan of overspending for a guy in his, you know, mid-30s. I don't think he's going to reproduce that there for the Yankees, but I think he's going to be solid. I think you're going to find a final stat line of his. He'll be between 240 and 250, 25 home runs, 85 RBIs. That kind of range, you know, give you 30 some odd doubles. I think that's what you're going to wind up getting, even with this bad start. I honestly do.
So, and before Bobo came on, we were talking about the Ike Davis trade, and you know, right off the bat, I didn't care who they got. I just thought it was a great move because they needed to address that situation at first, where it was like a convention going on. So, right off the bat, I thought it was good. But then I see that they get the minor league right-hander Zach Thornton. And then a player to be named later. I've never understood that, how you can make a deal and not know what the second guy is. But what is your take on the player to be named later and the Mets broadcast insistence that it's someone of significance?
Well, here's what – a lot of times with the player, and I'll give you a little knowledge, and it's not all the time, but a lot of times the player to be named later would be the Pirates would give you a group of guys. Say you're going to get to choose from these three guys at a later date, and the Mets will then get to continue to scout those guys. So it always seems like the infamous player to be named later, whatever it's going to be. A lot of times what they do is they'll give a little grouping, and they'll say, you know, here's the three guys, and the Mets don't maybe really know which one they want to pick yet, and they'll say, okay, you get until July 1st to decide which one you pick. It's not always that. Do you know that case, Danny?
I did know that. I have an interesting – you know, kind of question to bring
I'm
up.
I'm sure Anthony Recker was at one point a player to be named later.
No, right before you came down, before Bobo called, Neil had made a comment.
He called about 8:30.
Yeah, he did. And Neil said the good thing for Ike, maybe he just couldn't play in New York. Okay? And it brought me to this little place in my brain as the pro Jeter guy, where you hear a lot of people say about Jeter, who's left for dead, and the next ESA is batting 291. I don't know when he's done tonight and all that, but you know, he's always left for dead. He's famous. He's this, he's that. He's overrated. Meanwhile, he's played his whole career in New York. produced here. Mm-hmm. So where is the line? Where is the line between guys that play in New York, produce in New York, a la Jeter or Whitey Ford or Yogi Berra, whoever you want to talk about, and then where are the guys that just can't play here? Because you can't say that Jeter got to play here. That's a benefit.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And then penalize the guy. And where is the line between a guy who can't play under the pressure and then a guy who just thrives?
Well, I will say this. I think there needs to be a separation between playing in New York for the Mets and playing in New York for the Yankees. Because anybody that has any talent to play for the Mets is a savior. Anybody that has any talent for the Yankees is, look at all the superstars we've had, kid. You know, and there's definitely another skill set that comes with each one of them. Jeter is perfect for it. So I agree with you that he needs to be elevated because of that. And I never was a huge fan of the idea that his stats were elevated. The only thing that I say is that when everybody wants to throw his rings out at me, Like, well,
he's a very good team.
That's why, I mean, you're going to say he's better than George Brett or whatever because he had more rings than George Brett.
No.
Like, well, no, look, baseball's not the kind of game where you could judge it by rings, in my opinion.
You know what's funny is Brett is the guy that always comes up for me in this argument. And I bring up Brett because I had a buddy say to me once that he goes, when were the Royals ever good? And you go, 1985. And I know there was that little ambiguous play at first base with the Cardinals and all that, but he won a World Series ring when they were good.
Yeah,
so he played under pressure. And it's like, I remember seeing Willie Mays interview for his 75th birthday, and they asked him about Stan Musial. And he said, he's the best hitter I ever saw. And he said, if he played in New York for the Giants, Dodgers, and Yankees, they would have built a monument for him on Fifth Avenue. Those are his words.
Yeah.
Yet Jeter comes along, and you hear people say, well, look at the team he was on. And I would say, he batted in front of Paul Neal, Bernie Williams, well, I mean, A-Rod, he's the bomb. But he didn't bat in front of, like, Willie McCovey. I mean, it wasn't like he was batting in front of guys that were 350 hitters all the time.
Yeah.
He was on some very good teams with good pitching, and they did a lot of the right things, those Brocious, Curtis, Dean Spencer, that I loved all those guys. But it's a guy who gets killed on because he had the benefit, quote-unquote, of playing for the Yankees. Then a guy like Ike scuffles, and he stinks. And I'm not saying that Neil is making this argument, but people do. He stinks because he's in New York. So, I mean, do you know, is there a line that's drawn where we can discern between the two?
Yeah, it's wherever Manhattan meets Queens.
Is that what it is?
When the Bronx meets Manhattan, there you go. Once you get over the Whitestone, there's the line. But as far as, like, Davis goes, I think before the season, Neil, you and I talked on air, I think we both agreed this guy will have some success elsewhere. It was the right move to trade him. Now, what they got back for him, a 25-year-old right-handed middle reliever who's never seen the major league, to me is more of an indication of what that market was because they were pushing him hard. And you would think, and for all these people that were like, Ike is the superstar, got 32 home runs, there's always a need for a guy with pop. And I'll remind you of a former Met who left the Mets and went on to have a 30 home run season, Mike Jacobs. Remember Mike Jacobs started out behind the plate, moved around. That guy had a 30. I mean, there's guys that have 30 home run seasons that aren't great hitters. I've always seen Ike Davis as his ceiling is Adam LaRoche. I still see him that way. It's kind of fitting that he's going over to Pittsburgh versus LaRoche at the time of Pittsburgh. So I feel like that's his ceiling. I think that he's in a good situation because he's still not going to play against lefties. I still think Gabby Sanchez is going to get all the starts against lefties.
That's what Hurdle said.
Yeah, I think you're going to get that. His competition was Travis Ichikawa.
Yeah.
Somehow he beat him out. So I think he's going to have some success. I mean, I think, you know, he hits a big grand slam. He had a good first series, really. He got hit in every game, the first three games. But I think you're going to see Ike settle back into a guy who's going to strike out a lot. He's a guy still going to have a sub-250 average, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, I'll let Neil go on this, but my 2 cents is it's a perfect spot for him. And I always find it interesting that it's always about, because we're here, what did the Mets get? What did the Yankees get for a trade? But I think for Ike, who is the party concerned with his trade, I think it's great. I think he gets to go to a good team where they already have a superstar with McCutchen.
Clubhouse.
It's a good clubhouse. It's a manager that knows how to kind of bring guys along. He's done it in Colorado. He's doing it here now, there now in Pittsburgh. I just think it's a good deal. And like you said, he's going to platoon with Sanchez. That's what Hurdle has said. It's a good hitter's park for a lefty. You know, he's got that short course with the big 21-foot high wall and all that stuff. I think it's good for him to get out of the limelight. He's no longer the bust for the Mets. He's the guy that the Pirates are hoping to kind of rejuvenate his career. I think it's great for Ike. And you'll see whatever the Mets are going to get out of Zach Gordon.
Yeah.
And the player to be named later. So I think it's good for Ike. as for the Mets, you'll see. But I'm happy to see Duda and Satin get a chance to play. I think it's a good deal for them, too.
Now, you brought up George Brett. He was once thrown out of a game in the infamous spine strike. Did you guys go over what happened in the Yankees today? Did you see the replay of what happened?
We saw the replay.
Neil, have you seen the replay of what happened with Pineda tonight in the Yankee Sox game?
No.
So he got kicked out of the game for Pintar. After he was accused and clearly blatantly had Pintar on his hand, he had a 1-2 count in the second or third inning. He was down 2-0. Farrell comes out, talks to the umpire. They go over there. Jeter smiling away like this is a big joke. Pineda smiling. They have him take off his glove. They have him turn his neck because apparently somebody in the Red Sox was like, he's got it behind his neck. And as he turns his neck, you can see it on the camera. It's like shiny. The umpire reaches up. It's like right behind his ear, feels it, and immediately just ejects him from the game. So, I mean, my question to you as the Mr. Anti-Steroid guy, this will be like a laughable thing, this guy, because why? He's cheating.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy that's a steroid, you can say all you want about how that's cheating the game. At least this guy, you can't just take steroids and get better. You have to go take steroids and then go to the gym for 2 hours a day. This guy just can use a foreign substance, and that's just part of the nature of the game and all this. And it'll be laughable. Jeter's out there laughing, Mr. Integrity, like it's no big deal. Why? That's one of my biggest problems. When you talk about, like, the guy, they found a bat that Mickey Mantle used in the game was cork. Like, after he passed away, a guy had got a bat, won in an auction, and they look at it. Cheating is cheating. You can't tell your kids some cheating is cheating and some cheating is not cheating. So why are these things laughable? That's part of baseball, fifth ballers, all the rest. But steroids is you've ruined the game. This guy should never step foot anywhere near a baseball diamond in the continental 48 states.
I'll tell you something, a little brief aside, was we had a fist fight in my neighborhood as a kid in a wiffle ball game where we had two balls in play, one that the other team was using, one that me and my buddies were using. We found out the kid was scuffing a wiffle ball, and we had a fist fight. That's how annoyed you get as a hitter when you know the pitcher is trying to do something to, you know, make the ball jump around. Coach Ireland asked me when we were off the air there, what do I think he gets as a suspension for this? And my knee-jerk reaction was 5 games.
Yeah, I mean, really, he'll miss 1 start.
5 games, because that's, yeah, exactly. That'll be 1 start. But then I said to Coach, that way guys only miss 50. I mean, that's what they miss. This is cheating along the same lines that you alluded to it. I'm anti all this stuff, anti the core fast, anti any of this crap. That is just so overtly disrespectful to everything in the game. You're playing at Fenway Park against the Red Sox. It should be a great deal. Place is packed, and you have an illegal substance on your neck. You don't even have to
put it somewhere. Start after
right.
You've already been.
You don't either. Why don't you put it in your glove and you heal your glove? It's like he's not even trying to hide it.
Yeah, their last start was against the Red Sox, The thing is, so I'm on Facebook upstairs, and you guys are, having your show, and you see there's the Yankee fans, all of them, this is blown out of proportion, whiny Red Sox, whiny this. Do you remember that start that Kenny Rogers had back when he was playing for the Dodgers? I mean, the Tigers.
Yeah.
And clearly he had something on, some sort of substance on his glove, or was it, or on his sleeve, or something like that. And that was the end all field. That's all anybody talked about. This guy's a cheater, blah, blah, blah. But when it's Yankee, it's just they're all blown out of proportion. It's either cheating or not cheating, Neil, right? I mean, you're either a cheater or you're not a cheater. It's one of the things my father always said. You're either a liar or you're not a liar. You're either a cheater or you're not a cheater. There's no gray area. Are you cheating? Are you breaking the rules? Or are you not breaking the freaking rules?
Well, the thing that I don't get is that the first time around when it was first came out to everyone's attention, Boston played it off like they didn't care and like it didn't affect them. They didn't want to use it as an excuse. It was like a non-issue, and it very quickly became a non-issue. Like everyone, it seemed like around the league, it just everyone dismissed it. And then now he gets tossed. Mm-hmm. So obviously someone, it affected someone and to the point where they felt the need to say something. I guess they were just more upset with the fact that it was on his neck and that he wasn't hiding it properly.
I think it's the fact that he came out, like they almost gave him a pass. I don't think that the Red Sox, after the fact, are going to make a big deal out of it. And I think it's actually a smart gamesmanship thing to keep it in your back pocket and say, oh, no, 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 because there's nothing you could do after the fact. What were they going to do? He had it all washed off, and it was it.
So, no, it's not a big deal. Lull him into this sense of security where, well, they're not going to complain about it. And this idea that you hear all of these other pitchers, former pitchers, Al Leiter and the rest, saying everybody does that on a cold bed. There's no way to grip the baseball. What's illegal?
Yeah.
Then change the rule. Then make some, the rules are the rules. You can't just say, well, but everybody does it. Because that's the argument with steroids. It's the same argument.
Well, I've made that argument a million times. I mean, the thing for me, and again, I guess I'm a hayseed or I'm a simpleton or whatever, but I mean, I grew up, as I'm sure you guys did, watching games with my pops or whatever. And when things would happen that I didn't understand, I would ask them, why does this guy bat like this? Why is this guy bunting like this? Why did he do this? And then you're a young kid watching this game and you see that.
Yeah.
Now, there's people out there that say that I should just be quiet and it's not my issue. It is your issue if you love the game and you enjoy it. And it's part of the reason why I can't watch this stuff anymore is everybody cheats in this game. I'm not naive to think that guys don't cheat in the other three sports or that golfers or tennis players don't cheat. I'm just saying it's been an issue in this game now that we're aware of for, 7, 8, 9 years, probably going on for 30 or 40 or 50 or whatever, and now you got a guy greasing up the ball.
Right.
It's so stupid, and there are people out there watching it that just want to see some entertainment that's clean.
Yeah.
And I'm not wrong and stupid and idiotic or naive to think that that should be what I should expect when I turn on a game.
Right.
I mean, I should be able to just watch two teams play and not have a guy have crap on his neck or Vaseline on the ball or pine tar or whatever the hell they want to use. It's stupid.
Right.
They might have done it 60 years ago, but you know what the deal was? Everybody could throw a spitball. Everybody was allowed to throw it, so you just threw it.
Yeah.
So it was fine.
And they banned it.
They did it,
but
what I'm saying is I'm on the mound and you're on the mound for the other team. We both know it's not on the level, but everybody was doing it.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's one thing. But this is a deal where Lackey goes out there. He doesn't have anything on the ball. He's trying to get out a good lineup with a regular baseball.
Yeah.
Well, he should have just greased it off.
Everybody wanted to say he did it a couple games ago because it was a really cold night. I don't know what the temperature up in Boston. It's not cold here today. It's gorgeous here today. So how much colder could it be up here? It's not the case that it's like a 25-degree night.
Right.
But then you know what? You're going to have the same people that for the last 2 days want to bash Mike Harvey for being an embarrassment to the game because he stuck up his middle finger in a Twitter picture at the hospital bed. But this guy's going to be laughable,
yep.
They already got some little witty thing going on in the back of the post for tomorrow. And it won't be like this guy's a cheater and a dirtbag. It's going to be something about the Red Sox whining and this like goofy thing.
When was the snow delay doubleheader best that the Mets had in Colorado? Was that last year? Remember they had that doubleheader?
Yeah, I do remember.
Wright had like 5 hits or whatever.
I do remember that.
That day was as miserable a day as I could ever remember watching a baseball game, and I don't remember anybody putting five on the ball.
Uh-huh.
You're at altitude where the ball's probably a little bit more slippery or whatever you want to say. Nobody did it.
Yeah.
That's the dumbest argument on the face of
the
earth.
Yeah, it's going to be dry up there.
Yeah, well then Lackey lives in Boston. Lackey didn't get the weather report today on
they got a lot of hot weather girls up in Boston.
So stupid.
All they do is watch weather up there. I mean, Neil, do you get the hypocrisy of what tomorrow's day in sports talk radio is going to be as compared to what it was today, where Francesca got to take calls and talk about how this kid doesn't know how to be a leader and this and that. And then tomorrow it's going to be a side note, laughable thing, I'm sure, about, the Yankees, that's just part of baseball. They're going to have all these former pitchers coming out saying everybody does it. Don't you see the hypocrisy in that, Neil? You're a pitcher.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me regret my playing career. The fact that I never thought to take – crossed my mind to use any kind of, use any kind of tactic to get ahead and to cheat. It's a big regret of mine. Because especially like in high school or like D3, where it's like it'd be even easier because you don't have the eye on you for that kind of stuff.
You would have gotten away with anything at Johns Hopkins.
Yeah, and it just never crossed my mind. Because in my gut, which is substantial. I've been eating a lot lately and not worked out, but. In my mind, it was like it's me versus this guy, like it's just mano a mano, and like he's not juicing hopefully, and I'm not juicing, and this is like natural baseball, and it's just talent versus talent, skill versus skill. That was my hope, and it might be a romantic, ideal of baseball, but that was just how I envisioned it. And then we go and play a team like friggin' Montclair State, the former Trenton State, which is now the College of New Jersey, and their forearms are the size of my quad. So it's like, you know, at that point I'm thinking, all right, maybe I should have done something to prepare for this. But, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's like I just never crossed my mind. And, yes, honestly, there should be a severe punishment for Pineda because – but then you look back at, like, the Gaylord Perry. I mean, wasn't that – that guy has become a legend, an icon, and he did pretty much everything in the book. Am I wrong?
Yeah, that's the hypocrisy that I'm saying. That's what frustrates me about guys like Dan. And I'm glad to hear him say that he's on the same page as me on both sides. But that's what frustrates me about the same guys who talk about the love of the game, about how, like, the Gaylord Perrys of the world and Phil Negroes of the world were just these lovable characters of the game and the fabric of the game. But guys who took steroids and worked their ass off in the weight room are just the scum of the earth. I think they're both cheaters, except one of them took the easy way out, and one of them actually worked hard in the weight room.
I'll tell you my theory, and I watched the whole thing with Garrett Cole, Carlos Gomez, all that stuff, all the shenanigans, all the stuff with
Puig. Yeah, let's talk about that.
All the stuff with Puig and all that stuff. And I've said it for years, and I guess I come across some kind of barbarian. But I've always argued that if you just let the players police the game, and
yeah,
you let these pitchers throw at hitters that are embarrassing them or showing them up or whatever you want to say, stop throwing managers out because their pitcher hit somebody. It's so stupid. It turns the game into like a tickle contest. And it's dumb.
Yeah.
And if you let Gomez run around the bases like that and you could throw at hitters, whoever's waiting on deck is going to be like, dude, what the hell are you doing?
Exactly.
If you could just throw at them, that next guy, Cole's going to be nodding his head, biting his lip, going, I'm going to put this ball
right
through Ryan Braun's ear hole when it finally
right
comes up. And your own teammates will do it. That's why in the 50s and 60s, people think Hank Aaron was just a great guy, and I love Hank Aaron. He'll tell you he got around the bases so that his teammates didn't get killed.
Yeah, yeah.
He got around the bases in 10 seconds so that Eddie Matthews wasn't killed by a fastball
right
in his head.
But I think that there would be – I think there still would be those bad boy teams, which would be fine.
It's fine.
Somebody asked me a question on Facebook. I didn't even respond to it, but it was like, do you have a problem with it? I don't have a – I mean, do I think the guy's a D-bag for the way he handles it? Yeah, I do. Do I have any problem with the way Garrett Cole handled it? No. To me, it's like – but I don't, like you said, I don't like this, like, police state where this guy doesn't have the ability to do that.
Yeah.
I like the idea, like Bryce Harper. You know I have frustrations with Bryce Harper. But he has every right to do that. And I honestly believe that those guys, I believe that if Carlos Gomez took a step back and did not have that cocky edge to him, baseball's such a game of, like, you know, fine lines between you could be really good and the next day be terrible. I think that, when they tried to pair back Jose Reyes, he never was the same player as he was when he was shine the spotlight
right
on everything. And you know what? It's annoying, and his teammates are going to pay for it, blah, blah, blah. But that's what gets him there. And I just like that part of the game. I like personalities. I hate this guy. I like this. Going to go after this guy, blah, 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 blah. That's fine with me. That's sports.
I've never disagreed with you in the fact that there are certain guys that play a little bit of an edge, and it's beneficial for them. Like, I never played at that level, but I didn't play that way. Like, I wasn't that kind of guy. I wasn't going to show up somebody or whatever. Would Gomez play with that same bravado? Probably to some extent. So would Reyes. So would Puig. They would. So would Harper. You know, whatever they want to do. But when the threat at the end of the day is a 97-mile-an-hour fastball in your ear hole from Garrett Cole, you're probably going to get around the bases. Otherwise, what happens is everybody thinks it turns into the Pirates are going to police the Brewers. For ages, it would be the Brewers letting guys know, like, look, dude, I'm tired of coming up getting hit by Walter Johnson's fastball in my net. Like,
yeah,
you have to stop doing that stuff. It's always people think it's going to turn into this old Roman Coliseum, like, barbaric display, and it's probably not. It's going to be, you know what, you want to hit Gina with another fastball from Boston, then we're just going to flunk Poppy, or we're going to hit Manny
yeah
back in the day. We're going to police it ourselves.
Yeah.
And the guys on your own team are going to tell you, like, I would tell you, like, dude, you're batting ahead of me. Stop doing it. Stop doing it, man.
But
you're going to hit me every time.
But that's like part of sports to me.
That is.
Same thing if you were playing in your backyard. Like, I always take sports to playing with, like, your story about wiffle ball. Like, to me, at the end of the day, it's all it is. Just these guys are much better. It's just playing. And you'd be like the guy who is the D-bag playing in a pickup basketball game, and you're like, you know, you're on his team, and you're like, dude, just stop being
yeah
that guy. But, you know, it's part of sports. I don't know. I don't know. Neil, let's take a quick break. You got some duty you serious to end the show or what?
Yeah.
Yeah, geez. I'll be right back.
They come from the earth, dirty, ragged. But inside is a natural sweetness that comes from being wrapped in the earth's embrace and gently caressed by the hands of loving fathers.
Whoa. This ain't no romance novel. It's just a sweet potato.
Nature's Sweet Potato, now in McCain Super Fries. McCain, it's all good.
Neil, do you notice when I'm on the boards, we come back with a little bounce on our step, with a little, like how I bring the thing back with my sweet potato commercial? You like that, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, you're just pure energy in human form. I don't know how other way to describe it.
Speaking of pure energy, I'm going to see Mr. Neil Lynch this Friday night at the Metropolitan Comedy Club. Is that what it's called, Neil? I'm not. I'm just taking the train in and I'm just going to push my way there.
Yeah, it's the Metropolitan Room. It's actually, the original Gotham Comedy Club was originally there, and then they moved it over to 23rd, and now it's a kind of more of a jazz club. So you might – don't be surprised if you walk in and there's a lot of sequins and a lot of heavy-set African-American women who have got killer pipes. Don't be surprised if you see that.
Oh, so now I know. Now I know that my attire is going to fit that zone, which I like. I appreciate that. Well, heads up. I didn't know that's what I was walking into. Maybe a little jazz flute, Anchorman style. I like it. All right, Neil. We've got like 15 minutes, dude. We got plenty of time to give us some duty. You serious? Give me some energy to close out our week here. What do we got?
All right, I got a kind of a this or that, a battle, if you will, of disgusting sports items that people are willing to actually spend their hard-earned money on. The first item. Up for bid. I always get this guy's last name wrong. Kyler Seguin. He's played for the Bruins. I guess he's playing for the Stars now. He is now, it's his game used jock is available for purchase. So that's item one. There's a market for that kind of material. And then item two is Manny Pacquiao's bloody boxing trunk, which sold for $40,000. Now, sports fan, you got to pick one. What are you putting your money down on? Manny Pacquiao's bloody trunks or Tyler Seguin's game-used jock?
I don't even think it's a debatable question. You got to go Manny Pacquiao's bloody trunks. At least you could put that in a frame. And a boxing fight of a great boxer is something you could actually have in your room. Like,
you could explain that.
You could explain. Like, those are Manny Pacquiao's trunks. There's some blood on it, blah, blah, blah. You can't explain, and there's no way to display a jock of any nature. I don't care if it was the jock that Hank Aaron was wearing when he broke the home run record. You can't explain that to anything. You could explain a pair of bloody boxing trunks to anybody. Am I wrong? You know what I mean?
No, I agree 100%. I mean, I know Seguin is quite the man about town, and he's big with the ladies. He was in Boston, so maybe there's a market for that with the ladies that we're not even considering.
That's probably what it is.
But for me, I don't want anyone's jock strap. I agree. I don't want Hank Aaron's. I don't want Babe Ruth's. I don't want anybody's jock strap. The boxing trunks you could put up in a nice case, explain it. Like, this guy's a good fighter, man. I guess I'm a billionaire.
I could put that in the studio, and you could at least explain it. Mm-hmm. A little blood on it. You know, Manny Pacquiao. I'm taking Manny Pacquiao. Neil, are you going the other direction? God, I hope not. I'm not coming up front.
Yeah. I got to go Tyler Seguin on this. $40,000 is a lot of moolah for Manny Pacquiao's bloody trunks. And, you know, the blood type thing, who knows how that morphs into, you know, maybe someone tries to steal that blood and, like, clone him, but then the clone gets messed up, and then there's, like, a crazed Manny Pacquiao clone going around eating people. Keep the blood to yourself. And your $40,000. Plus, we don't even know how much this game-used jock is going for. Santa hit the nail on the head. There could be a huge upside to this with the ladies. You have that stellar side. You say, hey, girls, you know who's a good friend of mine? Tyler Seguin. You know why he's a good friend of mine because he lets me take care of his jock. And then you show him the jock, and they can get all high and mighty, and then you swoop in and you do your thing. Now, I'm taken, so I'm not going to do that, but I'm saying for all the single guys out there, this is a huge deal. There's no price listed at this point. If you come in low, who knows what Sagan's career ends up being. The guy's still young. The guy could go on to be an all-star. It could be like the man about town. It could be the Hugh Hefner of NHL. So in my mind, you buy low, sell high, low risk. Tyler Sagan's junk. You got to go for it.
Neil, as a hockey fan, do you remember last year, he's in Dallas now. He was part of the Louis Erickson trade. But do you remember those two girls that were at the Boston Garden holding up a sign for Tyler Sagan?
Yeah.
Do you remember that at all?
Yeah, sure. That thing. I thought that was a Photoshop.
No. So that's what I'm saying. That's what's market is with old Tyler.
But so those are the girls you want to go to deal with?
I'm just saying, if they're going to pay good money, I'll sell them my Josh Bat. They don't want it. What's it worth?
Well, I don't.
I wore this for a meal.
I don't know this guy Sagan, but I'm, as a purchaser of it, you get a girl back to your apartment, and the only way you're closing the deal is a jock strap out of your top drawer. You got to work on your game, buddy.
But I'm arguing the other way. I'm arguing if I go to her apartment.
You just pull it out of your back pocket?
No. Oh, she works. I'm going, what are you doing?
Okay. I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not a great argument, but it's the one I'm making.
At least it's an argument.
Yeah,
I didn't even see. That's why you should be a lawyer, because I didn't even see. You're like defending the murderer right now. All right, what else you got, Neil?
You want to talk about murder? Segway alert. It's been a Oscar Pistorius has been accused of portraying real human emotion during his trial.
I mean, you've got to pull out all the stops. The guy clearly murdered this poor woman.
Absolutely.
I mean, nobody just says, hears a noise and just goes guns a-blazing.
Yeah.
You hear a noise in my house all the time, everybody in my neighborhood would be dead.
I heard your daughter yell before you got down here. I just stayed down here for
talking. Go 70 Sam style,
yeah.
Just shooting up to the roof.
Yeah. I didn't say that's the little one. Let me go up there and see what's cracking.
Yeah.
This guy.
Pull out the Glock.
This guy, I've watched some of that on television, maybe 10 minutes of it.
Yeah.
Over about 2 days, probably 5 minutes each day. And there's not a bigger scumbag on the face of the planet. And I know it's, in our country at least, it's innocent until proven guilty, but this guy is such a bum that it doesn't even shock me.
Yeah.
That he would take acting lessons. I mean, this is beyond O.J. Simpsonian friggin' standards here. I didn't hear about O.J. taking acting lessons. Did you?
Well, he was an established actor.
Yeah.
This guy was in A Naked Gun, 1, 2, and 3 and 3rd, I think.
Right, but he didn't get on the stage. He didn't even have to. I mean, don't.
Oh, he did. He did like silent, like old school thing where he just put the glove on.
Yeah.
He did like old vaudeville.
He seemed to have this like draconian law setup over there where you have to testify.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like another world completely. And
South Africa, I've been there. It's an odd place.
Yeah. So this guy's a bomb. I hope they fry him a little.
Oh yeah. I agree. All right, Neil. Give him the chair. What else you got?
Well, I mean, you want to talk about cold-blooded killing. Mr. Met was once threatened by the Secret Service because he approached Bill Clinton.
Who was threatened?
Mr. Met himself was threatened by the Secret Service. They were like,
say
we will
again.
Shoot you
say
down.
What again? I dare you. I double dare you, motherfucker.
Yeah,
look.
Mr.
I mean... I think I saw that headline. I didn't know if it was an Onion headline. We got close to Bill Clinton, and he almost got one in the back of the ear.
I did not hear that.
What's Mr. Met doing close to Bill Clinton?
Maybe he just thinks he's bad luck.
I don't know. Like a box on him.
Like a box on him.
I mean, can we? What's that? That just makes it a segue, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, there were this guy, A.J. Mass, who's now a writer for ESPN. He actually was Mr. Met for 3 or 4 years in the mid-90s, in the heyday before the pre-Mike Piazza era, when the likes of Bernard Gilkey, Lance Johnson, and whoever were roaming Shea Stadium. He apparently has a book coming out, and he said that no crazy stories about drugs or sex, but he did retell the story of when Bill Clinton was at Shea to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Jackie Robinson. And apparently, yeah, The Secret Service agent told Mass, we have snipers all around the stadium just in case something that were to happen. Like I said, do whatever it is you normally do. Do it as whatever you would normally do. Nobody will bother you, but approach the president, and we go for the kill shot. Are we clear? Quote, unquote.
Now, let me give you a segue for all segues. We actually have in studio a former professional mascot for the Bridgeport Bluefish Independent League team in studio. I'm not going to give his name out. I'm sure he doesn't want to give it out. But this is a God's honest truth. We got a former mascot. Now, what was your title there? Were you like a pirate? What was your guy?
I was BB the Bluefish.
BB the Bluefish is in studio here. Now, did you ever have any celebrity that you were close to? And was there ever a time where the organization told you, here's the rule. Don't get close.
No.
The
biggest rule they had was, under no circumstances can you talk. And I broke that rule in my second game. The worst part is when you see like a group of 10-year-old boys together because you knew they were just going to mess around with you. So this one group kept doing it. The second game. So finally, this one kid was walking. I got right behind him. I said, if you hit me that bad again, I'm going to hit you. And I walked right underneath the bleachers into my little space and never seen
it. You were just the Bluefish?
As the Bluefish. You hit me with that wooden bat again, I'm going to hit you.
I'm sure Mr. Met's given those threats. If Mr. Met, Neil, ever told you, if you hit me with a bat again, I'm going to kill you.
It was literally, I don't care what it is.
Right.
Just the idea that this thing can talk.
Yeah.
And just, like, can give you a threat. Neil, what would you have done? Little poopies in your pants piece?
I mean, you want to talk about scarred for life. I don't know that I would ever leave my house.
Well, you're like Sigourney Weaver in that movie where she couldn't leave the house.
Kid, if you're listening, BB, sorry.
All right, what else you got, dude?
The coach of the Ugandan National Junior Running Team, if that's even a thing, doesn't sound real, has been suspended following allegations of systematic mental, physical, and sexual child abuse. One anonymous runner spoke to the Daily Monitor and said the scene is predictably horrific. He used to tell girls, you must have sex or give birth.
You said Uganda, right, Neil?
Uganda. You got it.
Yeah. I'm immediately not surprised that anything shady is going on in Uganda or Rwanda, any of those places. So it doesn't surprise me that there's craziness going on. I mean, I watch the news, dude. I see some of the stuff that goes on there, and just threatening a runner doesn't seem that bad compared to some of the other kind of mutilations they get into. So I'm not surprised. Might be surprised by that.
I'm not 100% sure. Maybe Mr. Bluefish over here can confirm this. But I think Mr. Echo from Lost was from Uganda, and he got, like, recruited into this thing and went up killing, like, hundreds of people. Do you remember Mr. Bluefish? He's from Uganda, Rwanda?
He was from one of those countries.
From one of those places.
Yeah.
So threatening a runner is nothing.
No.
These are Mr. Echo. And they came out, and they made Mr. Echo a bad dude.
All right. Well, on a lighter note, I hope you guys
cover Lost. We're part of the NDB Media family, and there is a Lost show on our network, which you should check out Saturday night. They recap every Lost episode. It's a great show. It gets 30 times as many listeners as we do. So God bless them, my man Zeke.
The show ended like 4 years ago, Mike. It ended 5 years ago, and it ended horribly. Why is this?
You know what just ended? Your Due to You Serious segment, because we got 90 seconds left, Neil, and you don't get loud with me. I only get like 30 minutes a week now, so I come down here, you don't come yell at me. Now, we got a good thing going on the website right now. We have our favorite albums front to back, and people are a little confused about it. Your favorite album, it's not necessarily your favorite album, but your favorite album you can listen to straight through. There's not one song you're going to skip in the old, like, cassette tape you're going to fast forward to. We got a couple more left. You came through with Dylan. Maddie came through with a nice Wish You Were Here. I was going to go with Dark Side of the Moon, but I feel like now I can't.
You're not hard.
No, it's putting it over to me. The Pink Floyd show now. Don't want to be a couple of hippies here.
Didn't you interview the
He's a close personal friend. I don't want him to think I'm kissing his ass, Neil. I mean, I want to see something out of you, Neil, on Saturday. Hopefully Tony D's going to come through with some 36 Chambers reference in his article or whatever he's got. We're the Tri-State Sports Guys. Check us out every week, Wednesday night, 8 o'clock. Thanks again to John Daly, Scott Burrell. Sorry we didn't get to you tonight, but hopefully next week. Check us out every week, TriSportsGuys.com, Facebook.com/TriStateSportsGuys, @TriState_sports. We got some live shows coming up. Check out Neil at the Metropolitan Room. Bring your whole Jazz 5 thing going on. It's going to be great. So we'll see you next week. All right? Boom.